Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So today's sutta will be the Girimānanda Sutta, which is in the Anguttara Nikaya, which is the fourth section of the Tipitaka. It has been pretty well translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi in these little books called the Numerical Discourses, an anthology from that collection. But as we speak, the full translation is being done. By Bhikkhu Bodhi. Ajahn Pamadi from Bodhinyana is helping out, do some of the proofreading and commenting. So that should be coming out, I don't know, maybe a year's time? Maybe 4 years, he says. Wow, 4 years before it's finished. But it's being done now, it takes a lot of work. But it's a wonderful selection of suttas, and it'd be great to have them available in English for the Buddhist world, so you get a much more thorough understanding of the teachings of the Buddha. And one of the famous suttas from that collection is the Girimānanda Sutta. It's very famous amongst the monks, simply because it's like a compendium of meditations. And it has some of the most famous meditations of the Buddha, which is not just, you know, the tenth here, the mindfulness of the breath, but also developing contemplations. In other words, looking at life through the lens of things like impermanence or abandoning or fading away. And these are powerful techniques of meditation to develop the mind in states of peace and freedom according to Dhamma. So this has been a very, very well-known sutta. And of many suttas which the monks of our tradition learn by heart, the Girimānanda Sutta is one of them, because it's something which they can take with them when they're in the forest or in seclusion to remind themselves of some of the basic meditation techniques of the Buddha. So this is actually why it's a very, very well-known sutta, and why it was asked to be talked about today by someone who's going to listen on the internet in Los Angeles later on. So here we start, the Girimānanda Sutta. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove in Anathapindika's monastery. At that time, the Venerable Girimānanda was afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. Then the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. And so seated, he said this to the Blessed One. Lord, the Venerable Girimānanda is afflicted, suffering, and gravely ill. It would be good, Lord, if the Blessed One would go to him out of compassion. And as many of you would know, if you've stayed at our monasteries, or even if you've visited those monasteries, we always do look after each other if ever any monk is sick. And in this particular case, Girimānanda was very sick, and the Venerable Ananda asked even if the Buddha would go and see him to cheer him up, give him some encouragement in his sickness. But it may also be he might have thought to be close to death. But in this particular case, the Buddha actually advised Ananda to go and see that monk, but to give him a teaching directly from the Buddha's mouth. The Buddha said, if, Ananda, you go to the monk Girimānanda and speak to him about the 10 perceptions, it is possible that he will be immediately cured of his affliction. What are the 10? Now, first of all, I would say about the possibility of being immediately cured of the affliction. I tell an anecdote, which is the clearest which I can tell you about some of the powers of joy and happiness when you have an affliction. Because once when I was a student, living in a house full of other students, to a student house to which I'd just moved in, I had a terrible cold, like a flu. And my eyes were watering, my nose was so streaming, coughing and sneezing, feeling so bad that that day I never went to college. I just stayed in the room in bed while all my friends left the house to go to lectures. So I was there by myself. And late in the morning, there was a knock on the door. And though I ignored it a couple of times, they would not give in. They kept on knocking. So I dragged myself in pajamas down to the door, and it was a delivery man who happened to be delivering my hi-fi system. And so I was quite happy I managed to drag myself down to the door to receive it and sign for it. And so I immediately dragged it to my room, set it up, and of course in those days that I preferred Jimi Hendrix to the word of the Buddha, I was very stupid in those days. But when I put on my first Jimi Hendrix record, it was a strange experience. My cold had completely disappeared. It had gone. And it wasn't as if I was just feeling bad. I had all the symptoms of a very, very bad cold. Sneezing and coughing and just mucus just dripping from your nose. And in just a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes, half an hour, however long it took, it had completely disappeared. Simply because the joy and the happiness of getting your entertainment system going when I was being apart from it for 2 or 3 weeks gave me that happiness. So if that can cure a cold or a cough, how much more that inspiring teachings can give you so much inner energy as if to abolish those symptoms and the cause of illness simply by the joy and the happiness which comes from hearing great teachings. And it seemed to be one of the traditions in Buddhism that if you did hear great teachings, even sicknesses would sometimes disappear. And that was actually the origin of doing all these paritta chants. The paritta chants, which you do when we go to people's houses or we chant for sick people, originally there were teachings which you would give to a person in their presence, and they'd be so powerful, they give them so much energy and inspiration, sometimes that would be enough to overcome the sickness. So when the Buddha says that it is possible that he would immediately be cured of his affliction by listening to these great teachings on the Dhamma, you can imagine how that can happen. It's just the power of inspiration. These are fantastic, brief but very powerful teachings on meditation. So any comments or questions on that before we continue on? Sanya, yes. Because Sanya, it's very interesting in the Thai word Sanya also carries the meaning of memory, keeping in mind, keeping that perception in mind. So in other words, when you go out of here, you keep in mind the perception of impermanence, which means that as you're walking, you can actually see the soles of your shoes, they're wearing away. And as you walk, every breath that which you're breathing out, it's one breath closer to your death. It's all perceptions of impermanence, perceptions of things always changing. So it's you keep that idea in your mind, that perception in your mind, that I call it maybe the lens through which you look at the experience of your life. You look through that particular lens, that particular perception, in order to not just to see the truth of that aspect of reality, but also to liberate the mind from the attachment to the world. It's a perception which is not only valid because of its truth, but it's useful and skillful because it leads to liberation. Yes, I will do. But actually, it is usually all sannyas for each one of these. These are 10 perceptions. But I think he maybe uses the word reflection here as a way of elaborating on the basic word of sannya perception. Because in Buddhism, the word sannya, it's just that aspect of the mind which gives the recognition of reality, usually say in terms of yellow or red, man or woman, hot or cold. It gives a way that the mind can cognize the world by categorizing it according to certain qualities. And instead of just using like the color perceptions, now we're using some more powerful perceptions, the instability perceptions, or you know, the mind just letting go of things perceptions. And those are useful perceptions to develop and cultivate, because not only are they accurate, but also they lead to enlightenment. Yes, Don. Asking if you listen to Pirit chanting and you don't understand all the words, can it still be beneficial? I must admit that sometimes I didn't understand every word which Jimi Hendrix sang. It was not clear either, but it certainly cured my cold that day. So it's certainly that one's faith and one's inspiration, I think that is the means by which those illnesses are cured, the inspiration, the joy, the faith which comes up. And you know, if that you have grown up on Pirit chanting, and if it does inspire you for one reason or another, then sure, that might have a powerful effect on you. Okay, and so, what are the 10 perceptions which the Buddha asked Venerable Ananda to tell the monk Girimananda? And as usual, the Buddha tells exactly what they are first of all, and then explains them afterwards. The perception of impermanence, the perception of non-self, the perception of foulness, the perception of danger, the perception of abandoning, the perception of dispassion, the perception of cessation, the perception of disenchantment with the whole world, the perception of impermanence in all foundations, and lastly, mindfulness of breathing. So starting at the beginning, number one, and what, Ananda, is the perception of impermanence? Here, Ananda, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, a monk reflects thus. You see, just by saying, going to a forest, the foot of a tree, an empty hut, these are the usual places of meditation. So here the monk is going to these places and reflecting what? The form, which includes body, you know, your own body, other people's bodies, things in the world, material form, is impermanent. Feeling is impermanent. Perception is impermanent. Volitional formations are impermanent. And even consciousness is impermanent. Thus he dwells contemplating impermanence in these five aggregates, the five khandhas, subject to clinging. This is called the perception of impermanence. Now, a couple of comments on that. First of all, the word impermanence, anicca, as many of you who have heard me talk before know, that it does not just mean a rise and a fall. It also has the meaning of inconstancy. Now, coming from my studies of the Vinaya in Pali, when I came across a term for a certain type of food called nitya food. If a person goes to the monastery every Monday, which people do, some people go Tuesday, some people go Wednesday, some people go Thursdays or Fridays. If you go on a certain day of the week regularly, we call that the regular supply of food. It is literally, in Pali, called nitya food. It's regular. It always is there, once a week. And anicca is the opposite of that, when something which was always there is now absent. It's not just a rise and fall. It also includes the disappearance of something which was always there, which now is no longer there. Like when you think of like your husband or your parents, say, being anicca, it means they were there in your life for such a long time, for so many years, and one day when they die, they're no longer there anymore. They're gone. And that feeling of someone who's always been in your life, you've never known life without them, And suddenly they're gone. Gives you an understanding of a deeper meaning of anicca. It's not rise and fall. It's something always there, and now it's disappeared. It's one of those reasons why I say there's so many things in our life which we just don't realize are there, because they are always there. So much so that we can't recognize them anymore. But one day when they vanish, we think, my goodness, now I know that that thing which I called a self, a me or mine, which I took for granted, it was always there for me. Now it's gone. And the example I give there, Sankara, the fourth of those khandhas, say volitional formations are impermanent. The will is one of the key sankharas of volitional formations. And some suttas the Buddha says that, you know, that is the biggest example of that khandha. Chedana, will. And what does it mean that will is impermanent? It not just means that will changes, it comes and goes. It is just that experience which one will recognize in the second jhana, where will is gone. Something which was regularly there, always at your command, able for you to exercise will at any time. Now you are unable to reach that will. You can't press that button anymore. What was always there for you, the potential to do things, is now removed. And that's a wonderful example of what anicca is. Something always there, gone. And that's even more important with the perception of the impermanence of consciousness. The impermanence of consciousness does not just mean that consciousness comes and goes and then comes again. It means that sometimes that consciousness comes and then it disappears and goes for long periods of time. It is the understanding that because this consciousness is not regular, it can stop. That's when one understands the importance of consciousness, this thing which one was always there for you, you know it's not always going to be there. The consciousness is subject to complete, utter ending. No. The stream of consciousness. You ask if the consciousness I'm referring to, what type of consciousness is that? I'm using one of the Buddha's metaphors as the stream of consciousness. And the stream of consciousness is very close to people's understanding of, you know, what the consciousness is. This conscious process which keeps flowing on like a stream of water. And very often you don't realize just when, you know, can that stream of consciousness suddenly stop? Can it sort of dry up? Can there no longer be consciousness there? Or is it just a temporary, like an anesthesia, then consciousness comes back afterwards? You know, is there an ending of consciousness? And by saying this, the Buddha said, yes, consciousness is anicca. It can stop. And because consciousness and will are the two, I call them citadels of the illusion of self. When we abandon everything else which we take ourselves to be, we usually fall back to say that I am the one who does. I am the one who's in control. Or I am the one who knows. I am the mind. Those are the two places where we assume there to be a self. That's why seeing, especially those last two of these five groups, five khandhas, investigating those with a perception that this will is anicca. It stops us, it's subject to ceasing. And this consciousness, this thing which is knowing and hearing right now, is not a regular thing. Then that completely undermines delusion of a self. Which is terrifying, but on the other side of terror, there's liberation. You're asking, are consciousness, mental formations and perception, are they always connected or are they separated? Yes, they are always connected. So it's like looking at one moment of sensory experience from different angles. Just like you have height, you have weight, you have shape, and you have your gender, you have your age. But I can't separate out those things, that's all part of you. In the same way the Buddha said, this experience, you know, called life, in this moment, can be looked at through these five angles. You know, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. You can't separate them. Which is why I've made a lot of emphasis on the fact you cannot be conscious without being conscious of something. The consciousness and the objects of consciousness, they depend upon each other. With nothing to be conscious of, consciousness shuts down. And this is basically, this is how meditation works. One lets go of the objects of consciousness by closing the eyes, being still, until those objects disappear. And so consciousness starts to turn off. First of all, the five external consciousness of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting and touching stops, because nothing's happening. The objects are removed. And then the consciousness which knows those objects stops. And then the mind consciousness slowly stops by going through the jhanas. As the objects which you're watching just become more and more refined. That's why, like in the arupa states, you've got things like infinite sort of space. You know, that's just a hard thing to pin down. And it's meant to be a hard thing to pin down, because it's not hardly anything there, which means the mind is turning off a bit more. When that sort of switch turns off, you're left with infinite consciousness, which is even less for the mind to watch. And so that turns off. And then you're left with nothing. You think, how can there be anything further than nothing? But you're perceiving the nothing. So then that turns off. And then the last thing, neither perception nor non-perception, the most subtle of all objects, hardly an object at all. So the objects of mind are being turned off. When the objects of consciousness fade away, then consciousness stops. That's why we have the arupa states. To see consciousness ceasing. Yes, so the higher realms where other only consciousness exists. Those very higher realms represent the what we call the Tiloka, the three worlds. When we say in the usual chanting of Itipi so bhagava arahang sama sambuddho vijja charana sampanno sukhato loka vidu, the knower of the worlds, and this is referring to the three worlds, the Tiloka. And those three worlds are the ordinary world of the five senses, which includes the heaven realms and the animal realms, the ghost realms as well, and of course human realms. But then above that, when you get into the jhanas and the Brahmaloka, which they call it, then we get the realm where, first of all, we have mind-made bodies, mano mayakaya, which is the Rupa Loka. And then above that, corresponding to the immaterial attainments, we've got Sanya Mayakaya, bodies or existences made of pure perception. So one is actually made of mind, and even higher than that, just made of perception, an even more refined object. The mind-made bodies really just depend upon the power of the bliss, to create and feed the being, and to sustain it. For the Sanya Mayakaya in Arupa, it's just a perception. Feeds on itself and maintains that state of being. So you're getting to very refined states of being. That's why you call them higher states of being. Yes.
Talking about that, can those beings get inspiration, or are they supposed to
Does beings, can they gain liberation? Are they subject to fall? Depends if they're extreme widows before they get into that state. This is according to the suttas, and you know, you can understand why this is true. That if they're extreme widows before they get into those states, that when those states fade away and disappear, anicca, so do they. They actually parinibbana from there, they cease from there. They never come back again, anywhere. However, a person has not got the attainment of stream winner, and you get reborn into those realms, then you will come back again. But remember, those are such refined states of consciousness. It's very hard to imagine a person dropping from such a high state to like to a hell realm, or even to a human birth where one is in a very low and painful form of human existence. Because of the high-mindedness of those states, it's almost certain that you'll be reborn into, if it's either Deva realm or a very, very noble family or rich family with lots of talents and obviously a very strong inclination to meditation. Sure, because gee, you've been in these states of meditation, such deep meditation for such a long time, you can't suddenly change your character and attitude. You'd be inclining towards those things again. So you're way ahead of the game. You don't lose too much. You lose something, obviously, coming to get rebirth as a human being. But, you know, you're way ahead. Yeah? Yes. Now, when you call about reflection here, it's like developing that perception of impermanence, so that you always keep it in mind. It's very close to even like the mindfulness, in the sense of not just knowing, but keeping what am I mindful of? Keeping the perception of impermanence in your mind, developing it. So you know, even when you're eating, you're not just eating for pleasure, you're seeing the impermanence, the fact that there's something was there, now it's disappeared. It's when you sort of hear people, you listen to Dhamma, or you feel inspiration in your body, you just see it just all fading away. It's like a very common experience, you know, which many people have. I remember when I had this, it's like you're standing on a platform and you can't stand, you're always slipping, it's always falling away, there's nothing to hold on to. It's like not quite a free fall because there's something you're standing on, but it's always slipping away from you. It's like sometimes people get terrified, the fact you've got no place to stand, nothing to hold on to, there's no way you can hang a hat or even rest, because everything is changing, falling away from you, falling, slipping, changing. There's no place you can establish consciousness or anything else. Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay, the monk Sati that was in, which sutta was that? Similarly, it's in the Majjhima Nikaya. But anyway, in that particular wrong view, he thought it was like consciousness being like a self, like a soul, like a jitta, like a mind, like an original mind. Something which is always there, which never changes. Like an essence, a core. Is that essence or core? You know, which obviously, because it's essential, because it's not subject to impermanence. At the time of death, it has to keep going. But it's that essential core which goes on, you know, between lives and from this life to the next life, you know, which makes up the person in the near-death experience, or which makes the core of the being when they get reborn. So it's like a core part of a human being which never changes. An atta, a self. And remember that when I said that many people... the last analysis, when they've made sure, you know, through their practice or their contemplation or even through reason, to see the body cannot be their self, their possessions are certainly not theirs, even their fame. But the last thing which they always hold on to is their will and consciousness. And even more so than will, consciousness. Knowing. And because of that, that monk Sati thought, no, I can let go of everything else, but this consciousness, you know, this one who knows, this is me, and this is what goes on from life to life. This one who knows. Does that explain it? Yeah. Okay, so that was his delusion. But actually, what is it that goes on from life to life? And as I mentioned, I don't know where it was recently, you know, the simile of the mango. And if we have a mango here and you eat it and then you plant the seed and 10 years later you get a new mango tree and you eat your first mango, what's gone across from that first mango to the next mango? When you actually look, is there anything there in this new mango which was there in the old mango? No, there's not. Even the DNA changes. The chemicals have changed, the cells have all changed. There's nothing which was in the original mango which is now in the new mango. But you can see the whole process. Every stage in that process, you can actually see something happening. You can see how it goes across in this process. How the old mango, you know, you put the seed in the ground. When it gets moisture, its first little shoot comes up, goes through the soil, you water it, you get this little sapling, and you nurture it, and maybe lose a few leaves, and it grows some more leaves, and it grows and grows. You can see the whole process. And then once it's grown into a tree, you can see the flowers come out and be pollinated, and then because the pollinated fruit, you can see the pollinated flower, the fruit start to grow. You see it grow from a small thing to a bigger thing, and then ripen, and then you've got your mango. You can see the whole process, the connection. But nothing goes across. And this is the stream of consciousness. Consciousness is a stream. Just like the waters in the Swan River. Never the same one moment after the next. They look the same. Every time I go home on a Sunday afternoon to Serpentine, you cross the Narrows Bridge. Well, not the, yeah, not the, the court, yeah, the Narrows Bridge. It always looks the same Swan River. But of course, it's completely different water every week. So your consciousness, it looks the same, but it's completely different, even every moment. This is the illusion, we think, that the consciousness is a thing, which will always be there, unchanging, rather than a stream, rather than a process. Okay, that's one, we've got another 9 to go. And what is the perception of no self? Here we go. This is very similar to what we've done with number one. Here Ananda, having gone to the forest to the foot of a tree or to an empty hut, you know, again in solitude, a monk reflects thus. The eye is non-self. Forms are non-self. That's what the eye sees. The ear is non-self. And sounds are non-self. The nose is non-self, odors are non-self, the tongue is non-self, tastes are non-self, this body is not self, and the objects, the tactile objects, are non-self. The mind is not self, and mind objects are not self. Thus he dwells contemplating non-self, anatta, in these 6 internal and external sense bases. This is called perception of non-self. So here, instead of looking at life through the 5 khandhas, you're looking at in terms of the sense basis. You see seeing, this seeing consciousness, it's not me, it's not I who is doing the seeing. And what I see is not mine. The full explanation of anatta is always usually the 3 aspects, not me, not mine, not a self. The not me business always goes with the idea of pride, of being better, being worse, or being the same. Measuring yourself, you know, by how well you can see, or hear, smell, taste, touch, or even know. Because we do create our identity on our abilities, on our achievements, even on our experience of life. Now, I am the one who's been to see the Himalaya mountains. You know, I am the one who has heard the Bernard Philharmonic. You know, I am the one who has, you know, I don't know what else you're going to say. But sometimes we measure ourselves by our experiences. But they say that we're not, that's what the me, I am better, worse, the same. But it's also the self, it's like the underlying essence. Is this the atta, the essence of me? And obviously seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. But also knowing. The mind, the citta, is non-self. It's not me, not mine, nothing to do with me. But also the mind business. So the eye is not yours. So if you lose your sight, don't take it personally. It wasn't yours to begin with. It just belonged to the body. It's nature's, not yours. Or you lose your hearing. You lose your sense of smell or taste or touch. Or even if you lose your mind, it wasn't yours to begin with. Or even better, the objects of those senses. I like to use the saying, it's none of my business. So whatever I see, all you people over here, you're none of my business. In an hour, half an hour, 45 minutes time, I'm going to walk out of here. I'm not going to carry you back to the monastery with me. Except this one over here next to me, and have a look. You're not mine. And even the aches and the pains in my body, especially when you get very sick, why do you allow those feelings to hurt you? Only when you think they're my feelings. And even all of your knowledge and understanding, even inspiration of listening to this talk today, is that really yours? Of course it's not. So when you look upon the senses and also the objects of your senses, what you experience has nothing to do with me, not mine. Of course, then we let them go, we detach. And because we detach and let them go, they don't obsess our minds. They fade away. And when they fade away, the consciousness fades with it. We go, we leave, we're done. Parinibbana. Cessation. But as long as you're interested in the objects of senses, you'll always go around samsara looking for more stimulation. More things to see, to hear, to know, to explore. Because you're identifying, you're owning your experiences. When you don't own them, when you discard them, there's nothing to do anymore. None of my business. So then you can be still. I don't know how busy you are, how many stuff, things you have to do at home, or in your work. But that's nothing compared to how busy you are with these six senses. How much you have to do with objects of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and the mind. That really keeps you busy day and night. Imagine when you can look upon that as work and now you've retired. Or long service leave, when you don't need to go to the office of the mind anymore. You can put it all down. Sight, smells, taste, touch, sounds, knowledge. Leave it alone and go on holiday. Again, ending samsara. As long as you have some interest in that realm, in any of those six realms, of course samsara will never end. You'll never stop. You'll always be the workaholic in the realm of in the office of the six senses. So that's number two. Number three. Now what, Ananda, is the perception of foulness? This gets more down to earth. Here, Ananda, a monk reviews this very body, this physical body, upwards from the soles of the feet and downwards from the tips of the hairs of the head, enclosed in skin, as full of many kinds of impurities. There are in this body head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, bowels, small intestines, contents of the stomach, excrement, bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, saliva, snot, fluid of the joints, and urine. Thus he dwells contemplating foulness in this body. This is called a perception of foulness. Or actually, the word is asupa, nothing really beautiful. Sometimes these negative words we got, like supa is always beautiful, nice, happy, and asupa, sometimes it's called a privative prefix. In other words, it doesn't really mean the opposite. It means like the absence of that thing, the absence of beauty, the absence of anything to really attach to. It doesn't always mean that it's foul or disgusting. It means there's nothing there to really enjoy or lust after. For those of you who have gone to like the forest tradition, you will sometimes hear the monks say the 32 parts of the body. And if ever you count all these, you'll find there's only 31. Because, you know, the one thing which was missing is the brain. So, the joke of today, this is a no-brainer. Because there's one thing missing. And so later it's actually the commentaries added part 32, the brain. But here, it was not seemed to be such an important thing. That's interesting. But anyway, whether it's 31 parts or 32 parts, or you can add a few more parts, which maybe the Buddha did not know in those days, it doesn't matter, it's just one way of mentally dissecting this body into its parts so that you don't get so attracted to this body. It takes away the perception of the beautiful with the body. And you can see why somebody who's practicing, especially as a monk or a nun, or on 8 precepts, staying in a monastery, is very useful to do these things, simply because it takes away the delight in bodies. And you only have to look at the newspaper, or probably watch a TV or a movie, to see how much of the world is captivated with the delight in beautiful bodies. And when you do this reflection, lust just nothing to be lusted after anymore. Even the most beautiful girl in the world, if you're a bloke, that's all they are. What's beautiful? The body hairs, the head hairs, the nails, the teeth, the skin, the flesh, the sinews, the bones. Do we say that Paris Hilton has got most beautiful kidneys? They're probably all shot now, all the stuff which she's put through her body. Because I was reading about it in the paper this morning. So, you wouldn't get any lust towards sort of Brad Pitt's liver, if that's your favourite boy film star, Brad Pitt's liver, or his bile, let alone his snot. But anyhow, that's why we sort of we look at all of this, and it just takes away the illusion of lust. And also, this is very useful in the time of sickness. Because one of the biggest problems with a sickness is our attachment to our body and seeing the body just fade away. It's what the body does. It's just kidneys doing kidney stuff. You know, the intestines just doing the intestine stuff. The blood just doing blood stuff. It's its nature, nothing to do with me. So that way the sickness does not become a personal failure. Four. And what, Ananda, is a perception of danger? Here, Ananda, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree or to an empty hut, a monk reflects thus, this body is a source of much pain and many dangers, for all sorts of ailments arise in this body, that is, eye disease, ear disease, nose disease, tongue disease, body disease, headache, mumps, mouth disease, toothache, coughs, asthma, colds, heartburn, fever, stomachache, fainting, body flux, whatever that is, gripes, cholera, leprosy, boils, plague, tuberculosis, falling sickness, itch, ringworm, smallpox, scab, pustule, jaundice, diabetes, piles, cancer, fistula, and afflictions due to bile, due to phlegm, due to wind, springing from conflict of the humours, produced by change of climate, by unaccustomed activity, by violence, by karma result, and cold, heat, hunger, thirst, excrement, and urine. And of course, that is not... That does not cover all the possible ailments which can affect a human being. And of course there's many more. That's just prescriptive rather than descriptive. So thus he dwells contemplating danger in this body. This is called the perception of danger. So in the same way that if a person becomes a soldier, you know, you do the perception of danger being a soldier. You're going to go to war. You know, sometimes you might step on a landmine or catch a bullet or be blown up. Or even just, you know, being captured and tortured and have your head cut off by terrorists. That's a danger of being a soldier. And you have to accept that if you're a soldier. If you join up, that is part of the contract. In the same way, the danger of being born as a human being in this body is to be prone to any one of these diseases at any time, and others which are not included in here. That's what happens being a human being. It's dangerous taking birth as a human being. So you know those dangers. And what that does is say, wow, this being a human being, being born as a human being, it sucks. If you haven't been sick yet, you get, actually usually you get the majority of your sicknesses in the latter half of your life. The early part of the life is quite delusory, simply because you're reasonably healthy, many of you. But obviously the older you get, the more liable you are to these sicknesses. And the sicknesses will only build up until one day they get so strong that your body can't stand it any longer and you'll die. That's the danger in this body. So when Giriyamananda, he would know this so clearly because he was suffering from this sickness. And he'd realize that now, delighting in this body or other people's body is a fool's game. And when he looks really deeply, he says, well, this is true. This is what happens when you have a body. And so he will never delight or want another body again. And that will give him the sense of detachment of this body to maybe get into the deepest meditations and let go of this body forever. Five. What, Ananda, is the perception of abandoning? This is Pahana. Here, Ananda, a monk does not tolerate an arisen thought of sensual desire. He abandons it, dispels it, obliterates it, annihilates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will. He abandons it, dispels it, obliterates it, annihilates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of violence. He abandons it, dispels it, obliterates it, annihilates it. And he does not tolerate arisen even unwholesome states. He abandons them, dispels them, obliterates them, annihilates them. This, Ananda, is called a perception of abandoning. Now, those first three you may recognize as the three factors of Michcha Sankhapa, wrong thought, the number two of the wrong Eightfold Path. This is like thoughts or intentions or plans, basically motivations. And these are the first three of the three wrong motivations. Whenever motivates oneself or moves according to sensory desire, ill will or harm. Instead, one motivates oneself through renunciation, through metta, loving kindness, and through gentleness, non-violence. And I made a lot about that recently, that when you meditate, please meditate not from sensory desire, ill will, or violence. Don't do violence to your body or to your mind when you're meditating. Be gentle. The word for violence is vihingsaka, and its opposite, which was made famous in the English language by Gandhi, was ahimsa, non-violence. And that's straight from the third part of the second factor of the Eightfold Path. And that non-violence is not just physical, it's also internal non-violence. So if you ever have a thought of violence, aggression, you dispel it, you abandon it, let alone thoughts of ill will towards someone who's called you a pig, or criticized you unfairly, or cheated you. You dispel it, abandon it. And even thoughts of sensory desire, fantasies, sexual fantasies, wanting something, you abandon it. So those are the perceptions of abandoning. And it's also, more than that, any other evil, unwholesome states. You continue this perception of always seeing how much you can let go. And that brings me on to that saying of a monk I respect very much, Venerable Panyawaro of Indonesia, who, when I was in Bali at a conference and asked a question which I didn't answer very deeply, but he gave a beautiful answer. When he was asked, why is it in many of the temples in Indonesia people go into those temples angry and they come out even more angry afterwards? They're supposed to be Buddhists, they're supposed to be meditators, why isn't it working? And he said it's because they go into those temples to get something. They don't go in there to let go and abandon things. And what a beautiful answer that was. How many people in the Buddhist world, they go into a temple to get good luck, to get karma, to get merit, to get jhanas or enlightenment or whatever else. You go on to a retreat to get something. And it's the wrong perception. What would it be like if we went into the temple to see how much we can abandon? How much we can leave here? And take less out when we go back home. So we go lighter than when we came in. That's the perception of abandoning. To lighten the burden by going to the temple, not to get something, but to abandon things. Avadananda is the perception of dispassion. Actually, this dispassion. Okay, well, leave it dispassion here. The word is viraga. And viraga, one of its meanings is dispassion, but its other meaning, and the meaning which is not used enough, is like fading away. Things vanishing. And in this context, and in many contexts in the suttas, I prefer the word fading away, the process of things just vanishing. So not dispassion here, but vanishings. So what is the perception of vanishings? Here, Ananda, having gone to the forest to food for a tree or to an empty hut, a monk reflects thus. This is peaceful, this is sublime, that is the stilling of all formations. That's sabbasankara samatha. Let's call the sankara the will. Not formations, that particular mental formation which I mentioned earlier, which the Buddha often said the will is the most important, the central part of these formations. This is peaceful, this is sublime, that is the samatering, the stilling of the will. The relinquishing of all acquisitions, all attainments. The destruction of craving, of wanting. This dispassion, we call just fading away. Nibbana. This is called the perception of fading away. And you can see why, instead of dispassion, fading away is a far more meaningful and accurate description of that term, viraga here. And this is peaceful, this is sublime. The stilling of the will and what's created by the will, the formations. The calming of it, the settling of it. That's the most peaceful, that's the sublime. So you don't reflect, yeah, seeing the movie tonight, that's the sublime. Yeah, you know, when my football team wins the grand final, that's the sublime. Or the greatest sex, that's the sublime. Or whatever else you think is the sublime. No, the stilling of formations, the calming of the will, and what's created by the will. That is the most peaceful, that is the most sublime. The relinquishing of all attainments and acquisitions. How much do you work really hard getting all your acquisitions and maintaining them, knowing that you'll abandon them all when you die? Sometimes it's such a burden working so hard for these acquisitions. And unfortunately, many people take that same motivation, that same attitude when they try and acquire spiritual attainments. Deep meditation, jhana, so on, or enlightenment itself. This is not about acquiring things or attaining things. It's about abandoning things. So instead we realize that the peaceful, the sublime, is relinquishing all of these things. Abandoning them, relinquishing all of this. That's the destruction of craving, where the world, together with you, fade away. Nibbana. That's the perception of things just disappearing, fading. Yes. Bodily, kaya sankhara, and citta sankhara, it really depends in which context. Bodily formations are the things created by the will in the physical world, like you're a bodily formation. Your breath, in this context of the Anapanasati Sutta, is a bodily formation. The mental formations, you can see that in the will is obviously the main mental formation, and what's created by that will, your inspiration or your anger, your depression, your peace, those are all mental formations. It's both. Because when you hear, it is coming from the body, but it's also, there's a mental part to it as well. You know you heard here. Yes. The stilling of the will, what does that mean? The only time the will is still is in jhanas. But as you, stilling of the will, what's that called? It's called letting go. Not doing anything. Stopping. Abandoning control. It's what you do in meditation, what you teach every week. What are you left with? Then the will starts again. So you know that when you are in this world, the will is part of that world. But you're calming that will, and especially you can calm that will whenever you wish. So in other words, at the time when you die, you can calm it. So it never creates any more formations ever again. Knowing where the will is coming from, it results in acting in the world. The will is still there, but it's not coming from you, it's not driven anymore. And what, number seven, what, Ananda, is the perception of cessation? Here, Ananda, having gone to the forest, the root of the tree, towards empty hut, a monk reflects thus, this is peaceful, this is sublime, that is, the stilling of all will formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, cessation, nibbana. This is called a perception of cessation. Exactly the same definition as the one before. Which actually just shows you that the stilling of these formations is cessation. The one above, because it's viraga, you're seeing it happen. Number seven is happened. You've seen things fade away. It's as if number six is a process, number seven is the goal. Formations are stilled, calmed, gone. So why sometimes the word for stilling is called samatha. When people keep on saying, no, no, you can't get to enlightenment through samatha. That's the whole job. It's samatha-ing, that's called stilling in this translation, the sankharas. That's what enlightenment is, that's the path to samatha, the sankharas. So when they say samatha doesn't lead to enlightenment, they don't know their Pali. Obviously it includes insight practice, but the main thing, even the goal of the main part of insight practice is to calm things down. It's the calming of these formations, the settling of them until they fade away and cease. That is the path of Buddhism. And what, Ananda, number eight, is the perception of disenchantment with the whole world. This is, by the whole world, it does not mean just this planet Earth. It's the Sabaloke. It means with all the three worlds. Not just this physical world, but I already mentioned the three worlds, the realm of hell realms, ghost realms, animal realms, human realms, deva realms, jhana realms, arupa realms, that's the immaterial planes, a whole lot. And disenchantment is that no delight, no love, no really getting into anything in these worlds. That's what it means by disenchantment. Hirananda, by abandoning any engagement and clinging to the world, to any mental standpoints, adherences and underlying tendency, he refrains from them and does not cling at all. This is called perception of disenchantment with the whole worlds. We should have an S on the end of that. With all the worlds. What does that mean? By abandoning any engagement. Those of you who have followed my teachings in meditation, sometimes I've taught you, whenever you say watching the breath, disengage. In other words, you can watch the breath as if the breath is natural, as no one's watching it. But when people first watch the breath in meditation, it's always unnatural. And why is it unnatural when you first watch it? Because you get involved with it. It's the nature of most people, whatever they observe, they get involved with it and they make it unpleasant for themselves. And the usual exercise is, now be aware of the saliva in your throat. Now it is uncomfortable. A moment or two ago it was fine. Why is it now uncomfortable? Because you're getting involved in it, you're engaged in it, you're trying to figure out whether to swallow or not to swallow. Now it is your problem, you have become engaged with your saliva. And this is a very difficult thing for people, to actually to watch something without engaging in it. To have that 100% equanimity, disengagement, non-involvement, you can watch things and not put your hand in to mess it about. Can you do that to life? It's tough. But this is what we train ourselves to do in meditation. To be able to watch the breath as if we weren't watching it. In other words, so the breath is the same whether we watch it or we don't watch it. We don't get involved, we don't disturb it. And especially gets true when you say, get to nimitta status. The nimitta, when it first arises, starts to get unstable. It's not its nature to be unstable, it means we get involved in it, we try and hold it, to brighten it, to do things. We engage with it, rather than having that equanimity just to watch, as if we weren't watching. And if we can disengage, that nimitta brightens up, becomes incredibly still. When the first experience of jhana happens to people, it's usually the ping pong jhana, as I wrote in the book. You get in there and you come out again afterwards. You know why? Because as soon as that happens, the mind engages. Yeah, it's mine. You get into it and you disturb it all. So a lot of times the practice of the samatha-ing is like learning how to watch and disengage at the same time. So whatever you're watching, yeah, it's good enough. Leave it alone. Don't try and drive the meditation process and make it happen. You completely disengage in every moment. And that's so important in the deeper stages of meditation. That's the perception of disengagement. So you're disengaging, abandoning of any engagement. This is even to the deep states in the world, let alone the ordinary life. And clinging to the world. You all know what clinging is. You know that cling wrap always sticks to things. You know, just, you know, if you've got a mind like cling wrap, whatever it sticks to, you know, it holds on to. So, the opposite of cling wrap, you know, in modern terminology, it's a Teflon mind. Nothing sticks to it at all. You know, the most beautiful praise, only the most wonderful meditator in the whole world. And you forget about that the next moment. You don't go around thinking, wow, yeah, I'm the best monkey in the whole world. Look at me, I'm the best monkey in the whole world. You should have a star or one of these t-shirts. You know, I am the best monkey in the whole world. That's not the... You don't cling to these things. In the same way, when you call the most stupid, idiotic, waste of time, a disgrace to the Buddha, Ajahn Brahm, you don't carry that. You don't cling to anything in this world. No praise, no blame. Nothing belongs to you. Nor do you cling to your attainments, cling to your experiences, cling to your past or your future. Yes? Now, vibhavadanha is another type of clinging. Vibhavadanha is a craving for extermination. It's close to right attitude, but still far enough away never to be able to attain enlightenment. It is the want to destroy samsara, you want to end things. But the point is that you want to do that ending. It's arising from a sense of self, as if you are in control. And it's the control of wanting to end things, to turn off the switch. No, but you are the switch. The switch can't turn itself off. That's the vibhavadanha, the self wanting to exterminate itself. And I often use the simile, which was from Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist, where this man would often make the curse, if Oliver comes back with that £5 note, then I'll eat my own head. And that, I first saw that in Charles Dickens. How can you eat your own head? You try to contemplate it, it's completely impossible, because you need a head to eat the head, at least somebody else's head. So that's the same with vibhavadanha, is trying to eat your own head. Cannot be done. And actually what the Buddha said, it's like the dog trying to chase its own tail. Goes round and round and round and round, but never gets anywhere. Because the self is trying to exterminate the self. That's vibhavadanha. What is the meditator doing when he gets ekaggata? He's doing nothing. The meditator's butting out. In other words, he's the meditator in the process of the meditation which leads to enlightenment is stilling the will. But he's not making the will still, because that's will trying to stop the will. He's doing this wonderful process called the middle way, where the will has nothing to do and turns off and slowly fades away. You can't say, I'm going to stop willing now. No more than someone can say, I'm going to now watch the breath. I think you can do it that way, by force of will. The word samadhi, these days, I used to use a few years ago, sustained attention, but I now prefer the word stillness for samadhi. Because stillness is a beautiful, evocative word, which not only describes so the deep stages of meditation, but also carries with it the fact that the path to stillness cannot be with agitation. Agitation is the opposite of stillness. And we never get to stillness through agitating the mind, through willing, through striving. So when I call samadhi stillness, it makes it very clear how you get to that goal and how you don't get to that goal. You're not trying to achieve or seek out, because you know that trying to achieve, to seek out, is agitation. You're calming things down. Okay, the abandoning any cling to the world and mental standpoints. This is actually a standpoint, is a place where you can sit and rest. where you can roost, where you can grow and make things. So there's no place your mind can rest and stand to establish its illusion of existence. Everything is fading away. So no place where you can stand. I remember once when I was a student going on a demonstration. The main reason I went on the demonstration because not was because I was politically active, but because all the other universities in England at that time were having demonstrations, and I went to Cambridge. I thought I was missing out. And I thought it was part of student life in the 60s and 70s to at least go to one demonstration in your life. So that's what I did. And when we went to a demonstration, it was against the law apparently to stand in a big crowd. But as long as you were moving, the police couldn't do anything about it. So we'd always like be moving around in a demonstration with the placards backwards and forwards, you know, the student march. Because that was the law. There's bylaws, you can't stand still and block the traffic, because you'd always walk. And so you always had to keep moving. And this is like mental standpoints. No place, it's like the Dharma police say, keep moving. You can't stop. In other words, there's no place your mind can stand. It's always falling and fading away. So no mental standpoints at all. No adherences, getting stuck, or underlying tendencies. The underlying tendencies. Sometimes they call them the defilements, the kilesas. There's many underlying tendencies. But you can see the underlying tendencies to stick to things. It's not just in the moment you can actually abandon things, but the underlying things which create those stickingness, that's also abandoned. So he refrains from them and does not cling. So this is the perception of disenchantment with the whole world. There's nothing anywhere in the world where you can cling to or stand on. No heaven realm, no God, no even a jhana or any other experience. We say, that's it. This is where I'm going to hang out. This is where I stand. Where you think you stand, there you make yourself. There's no place to stand. There's no place to nurture an identity. And the identity fades away and vanishes. And what Ananda is a perception of impermanence in all formations. Sabba sankhara anicca. Here Ananda, a monk, is repelled, humiliated and disgusted by all formations. This is called the perception of impermanence in all formations. What is seeing here, that none of this stuff you can keep. None of it you can hang on to. None of it you can stand on. What that arouses is this state of mind called nibbida. A nibbida is a wholesome negative force. Sometimes I use the metaphor that if you're stuck on the wheel of samsara, like a big Ferris wheel. When I was in London, it was only a short distance, you know, from the convention centre to the London Eye, this big Ferris wheel. And a few weeks later when I went to Singapore, I found there building an even bigger Ferris wheel. Ferris wheels are the in thing in cities these days. And that's like samsara. You go round and round and round and round on this big wheel, sometimes high like a heavenly being, and then you go into the lower realms. But how can you get off the wheel of samsara? Nibbida is samsara's ejection button. It pushes you off. Just letting go, equanimity, you still stay on that samsara. There's no force to get you off the wheel. It's a nibbida. To think, gee, this is, what am I got into? This round of rebirth, there is a negative movement caused by the perception, deep understanding of the Four Noble Truths of suffering. Of the inherent suffering and pain of existence. Which gives rise to nibbida. Which is the perception sometimes of the impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, of existence. When that happens, not coming from a sense of self, but coming a sense of realization, repelled, humiliated, and disgusted by samsara, that nibbida pushes you off and is part of the path to enlightenment. And what Ananda, the number 10, is mindfulness of breathing. This I will go through reasonably quickly because we've gone through Anapanasati Sutta before and I've talked about it at length. But if there's anything in here which you want me to pause on, I'll just give you the opportunity at the end. And what Ananda is mindfulness of breathing. Here Ananda, having gone to the forest, the foot of a tree or to an empty hut, a monk sits down, folding his legs crosswise, holding his body erect, setting up mindfulness. In front of him means giving it priority. Priority means putting in front, literally. In Latin, it comes from the Latin word. Not putting it in front of you here, but by giving it priority, you mean that's the main thing to establish first of all. So I'm very happy with that word, priority, because I think that really sort of establishes the meaning of this phrase in an English word which also carries the meaning of the Pali. Ever mindfully breathes in, mindfully breathes out. In a way I teach meditation, that's present moment awareness and silence. Breathing in long, he knows I breathe in long. Breathing out long, he knows I breathe out long. Breathing in short, you know I breathe in short. Breathing out short, you know I breathe out short. You don't need to do those in order. Whichever breath it is, either will do. Or if you're neither breathing in short or long, just so you're breathing in, that's all right. You notice it doesn't say where you breathe in. It doesn't say you watch the tip of the nose or your belly. It just says you know what the breath is doing. Experience the whole body, I will breathe in, he trains us. Experience the whole body, I will breathe out. That is an idiom. It is explained in the commentaries. It's even explained by the Buddha in one of the suttas, Anapanasati Sutta. It means watching the whole body of the breath. Because the Buddha in the Anapanasati Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, says, amongst the bodies are called the breath, one of those bodies. This does not mean watching your physical body. It certainly means watching the whole body of the breath, the very beginning of the in-breath, right to the end of the in-breath, watching the whole body, the whole of the out-breath to the very end. It's the whole body of breath is the usual translation, if you're using not word-for-word translation, but translating sentences. So experiencing the whole breath, I will breathe in, he trains himself. Experiencing the whole breath, I will breathe out, he trains us. Calming down the bodily formation, which again means the breath. I will breathe in. Calming down the breath, I will breathe out. That's watching the whole breath and calming it down. He trains us experiencing rapture. Piti, I will breathe in. He trains us experiencing rapture. I will breathe out. He trains us experiencing happiness. I will breathe in. Trains us experiencing happiness. I will breathe out. That's the stage I call the beautiful breath. Having calmed the whole breath down, you get the feeling of a delightful breath. It's just so nice to watch the breath. It's the piti and sukha arise with the breath. Experiencing the mental formation of our breathing, he trains us. Experiencing the mental formation of our breathe out, he trains us. Calming down the mental foundation of our breathing, he trains us. Calming down the mental formation of our breathe out, he trains us. They missed that out. And that means the mental formation is the piti sukha. The delight is the most important thing. Not so much the breath, but the delight. And then you calm down that delight. You just settle it. And of course, this is an important part of the meditation. People who go from the breath and they calm the breath down before arousing the delight, they go to a place where, yeah, they're peaceful, but nothing happens. They don't get any further. They go to, you know, almost like a dead-end street of meditation. Peaceful, but no oomph to it. It can't arouse the nimittas. So it's important that once you have the full breath in mind, you've calmed that breath in mind, you know, find ways. Sometimes it happens naturally, or sometimes do perceptions of beauty, or sometimes I've told people just to take your attention away from the breath for a second and put a smile on your face. And psychologically, that will give a like a striking a match of piti sukha to maybe like more piti sukha, more happiness and joy. And it works. It just gets the joy going. So as you breathe in and out, you develop that joy. And then you can experience that joy, calm things down. And the next stage, you train thus experiencing the jitta, I'll breathe in, this is the mind. He trains thus, experiencing the jitta, I'll breathe out. He trains thus, gladdening the mind, I'll breathe in. He trains thus, gladdening the mind, I'll breathe out. He trains thus, concentrating the mind, I'll breathe in. He trains thus, liberating, concentrating the mind, I'll breathe out. He trains thus, liberating the mind, I'll breathe in. He trains thus, liberating the mind, I'll breathe out. Experiencing the jitta, this is where you see the nimitta. The nimitta is a reflection of the jitta. This is how you experience the jitta. So this is where you experience the nimitta, you gladden the nimitta, which means that you make it brighter, make it more delightful, more beautiful. I call that shining up the nimitta. And concentrating the mind. Remember I already told you that I don't like the word concentration. Stilling the jitta, stabilizing it so it's not moving around, it's stable. So call that stilling the mind, I'll breathe in. Stilling the nimitta, I'll breathe out. He trains us. And then liberating it, liberating vimucchati. That's the verb, the noun is vimokkha, the eight vimokkhas are the jhanas. This means entering the jhana, liberating the mind completely from the five senses and from the hindrances. That signifies in this 12th step of anapanasati, the attainment of the jhana. It doesn't tell you what you do in those jhanas. That's another thing. But after you come out, he trains us, contemplating impermanence, I will breathe in. He trains us, contemplating impermanence, I will breathe out. He trains us, contemplating fading away, I will breathe in. He trains us, contemplating fading away, I will breathe out. He trains us, contemplating cessation, I will breathe in. He trains us, contemplating cessation, I will breathe out. He trains us, contemplating relinquishment, I will breathe in. He trains us, contemplating relinquishment, I will breathe out. This is what one does after the jhanas. Especially the impermanence, as I said, certain things in the jhanas are just not there anymore. They are unregular. Always been there, ever since you were born. And in those jhanas, they're just not there. Just like the tadpole always being in the water. Could never know what water is. Now tadpole is a frog, it's outside of the water. Now it knows that water is anicca. It's not regular. You can exist without it. Now you know that will is not important. You can exist without it. You know what will is now when you get out of it. You know what five senses are. You know what body is. Because now you're in a place where body is not anymore. How can you know what your body really is when it's always there, when you're right inside it? In the same way, how can you really, tadpole, know what water is? How can you know what your body is? How can tadpole know these things? How can you know what five senses are? Until you go to a place where the five senses and the body are not. That's impermanence. That's also the fading away of things. You see so many things disappearing. And you go deeper through the jhanas, you see even your mind fading away. And cessation. Gee, you've already seen five senses, body cease, will cease. See, much of your mind cease. You know what cessation is. All that is of the nature to arise. Your body, your mind, your will. It's also of a nature to stop. Cessation means stopping forever. It's gone, finished. Then relinquishment. Pati nisaga. You've relinquished not just what's outside. It's very easy to let go, relatively, of the external world. It's very easy to let go of your possessions and become a monk. It's very easy to let go of your family and be alone. But it's much harder to let go of your mind, your inner world, your controlling yourself. That's where the real relinquishment happens. It's easy to let go of things outside of you. But now you have to let go of the whole inner world and everything which lies inside on your side of the eyes and the ears and the nose and the body, not on my side. This is called mindfulness of breathing. If, Ananda, you go to the monk Girimananda and speak to him about these 10 perceptions, it is possible, upon hearing about them, he will be immediately cured of his affliction. Be so inspired, so uplifted, that the energy of this discourse might just dispel the causes of that sickness. Then, when the Venerable Ananda had learnt these 10 perceptions from the Blessed One, he went to the Venerable Girimananda and told him about them. When the Venerable Girimananda heard about these 10 perceptions, he was immediately cured of his affliction. The Venerable Girimananda rose from that affliction, and that was how the affliction was cured. It's a powerful sort of teaching there. It doesn't make any bones, no theories, this is just how you get enlightened. And even if you can't do it, it inspires you. Powerful, deep, meaningful, real teachings, which sort of inspires people so much. Wow. You forget your sicknesses, and you leave them behind. The Girimananda Sutra. Now, any questions about that? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. If it's not really, if you have an experience, I use the word I think for that school, because it was in Rolly Stone Primary School when I was teaching. It was actually a double class of grade ones and grade twos, if I can remember correctly. They put them all together. And I asked, you know, do you like rice pudding? It was. And they said, oh, we don't like rice pudding. Most people said they don't like it, but they'd never tasted it. But sometimes it's strange that, do you like enlightenment? And people say, yeah, we want to be enlightened. But have you ever tasted enlightenment? But in this particular case, until that you get the experience of rice pudding, then you can say whether you like it or not. So we have to have the experience of at least partial cessation, the experience of deep meditative states, to have that experience so that we're not just going on fantasy or dreams, expectations. Regard reality. Is that the question you're asking? Ah, okay, yeah. Ah, okay. I understand your question now. I would say the only way you can understand the five senses is actually to go to a place where those five senses aren't. In the same way, the only way that you can understand water as a tadpole is to get outside of the water. And how does that compare with the saying that unless you've eaten rice pudding, you don't know what it is? And I think that you do need to have, not just to eat rice pudding, if all you ever ate was rice pudding and you never had anything other than rice pudding, you wouldn't know what rice pudding was. In other words, it's always around you. So that's similarly with rice pudding. Because kids eat many, many different things. They know rice pudding, they know fish and chips, they know pasta, they know other things. Because a lot of times our knowledge depends upon some sort of perspective, some comparison. When something's always around you, when that's all you have, and it's constant, then you can't know it. I think with rice pudding, really, you'd have to be eating rice pudding every moment of the day, and then you wouldn't know it. But I think the experiencing needs to have some comparison. It needs to have, it's the nature of the brain to only know what changes. It's the same as when you have like the sound of the air conditioner. When it's constant, you can't hear it anymore. You know, the white noise effect. when the white noise is turned off, then you know what that white noise was. The brain just doesn't notice constancy. It's only when we're wired to actually to notice things which suddenly which change. So a sound which is always there, a feeling in the body which is constant. If it was truly constant, you wouldn't feel it anymore. You know, the worst type of pain is in the one which comes suddenly, the acute pain, and then it goes away again. I think that's pretty accurate according to neurology. Okay, yeah, that's very good. He's saying with rice pudding, like before you've eaten rice pudding, you know, you don't know what rice pudding is, but once you've eaten rice pudding, you know rice pudding, and everything that you eat afterwards, you know that's not rice pudding. Yeah, that makes sense. Yes? Yes. Yes. What do you do for brightening the mind? It's called Abhipamojyang Chitang. Pamoja is like delight, joy, happiness. And there's many ways of brightening a nimitta. You can brighten the nimitta before you enter meditation by being more virtuous, kind, generous, being a more beautiful person. Which means that when the nimitta comes up, your jitta will be a beautiful jitta because you've made it that way outside of meditation. If you can't do it outside of meditation, then when you have a nimitta, if you develop not the fault-finding mind, but what we call subha-sanya, the perception of the beautiful, the opposite of what the Buddha says here for the perceptions, asubha-sanya, that this is also, in some cases, you do asubha-sanya to, you know, take away the lusts. But when you're in meditation, it's great to do subha-sanya. You perceive the most beautiful part of the nimitta. You have the positive mind state, which doesn't look for the faults. The simile which I give is, yes, well, after 7 years as a monk, I was still living in Thailand, and I went to see my family in London, and Ajahn Sumedho had just started the monastery in Chitthurst, and he tried to actually to get me to stay in England, but it was actually Ajahn Chah said, no, he wanted me to go back to Thailand, and that really upset Ajahn Sumedho at the time. But Ajahn Sumedho took me up north to a, you know, a Dharma trip of north of England with him. I was looking after him. And one place we went to for a weekend retreat was the town of Darlington, which was a coal mining town. And as soon as we got there, they said, it's really amazing that you two come to Darlington on the weekend where everybody, it's such a sort of a run-down town, they always leave Darlington on the weekend to go anywhere else. And in the morning, we went for a walk before the meditation started to the park. There were some beautiful flowers there. It was very delightful. When we returned, our host said, where did you go today? I went to the park. And there was a beautiful church there as well. We had a look inside. I said, really amazing. Yeah, that's just your character. You know, your characters are always going to the beautiful. There was a monk there about a month ago. And when he went to Darlington, in his morning walk, he went to the gasworks. In the most run-down part of town, the dirty-smelling industrial area. He said, yeah, that's similar to him. You know, he's really, you know, into sort of the negative part of life. And if you can train yourself always to be the fault-finder, negative, and you can see that when you go looking for things, you actually look for the negative. And if you do that, when you have a nimitta, you'll always be moving towards the ugly side of the nimitta. Now, what's wrong with it? Because in a nimitta, there's always the bright part and there's always the duller part. And if you do the subha-sanya, quite naturally you always tend towards the beautiful part of the nimitta, and that will grow, that brightens the nimitta. You can't do it. This is, happens to be an inclination of the mind. You're moving towards that because you've trained yourself over a long time. That's right, yes. You can't suddenly, well, nimitta's up, what should I do next? You just disturb the whole process. Okay, that's, yes? Tactile objects means anything which you can know by touch. The objects of physical touch. So these are the mind and its objects. The five senses and their objects. It's another way of looking at the world. What is there anyway? Just know the eyes and the what you see with the eyes. Big deal. See, that's just a sound object. And you hear it. But then you say, I should turn off the mobile phones. And now you make the problem with it. You're not letting go. Yeah. To reflect on the subject of cessation, they would have to have seen some things cease. Even in just meditation, to see like time cease when you get into that state of, you know, the timeless present moment. Or to see the thinking cease. You've had some people who get very afraid in meditation when their hands disappear. I say, well, that's a cessation. You know, your perception of the hands, it's always been there. The thing is, it's not they can't feel the hands, but they can't make themselves feel the hands. They just can't do it, and that's what scares them. The hands aren't there to be felt. So the potential to feel the hands has been taken away from them. That scares them. So this is a cessation that happened. So there's many cessations which you can contemplate even before you get into the deeper meditations. It gives you an understanding of what's going on. And from those experiences you can infer what the bigger experiences are like. Are they useful for enlightened beings? Of course they are, but the enlightened beings will do them naturally, without needing to force them. So, you know, if you're not enlightened, it's good to encourage them. That's why many monks actually say either remember this, learn this off by heart, and chant it to themselves as a little like meditation manual they can take around with them. Yes. We don't know anything, so but we're not really stilling things because the mind is still dreaming very often, but we don't remember the dreams. And I think if you watch people in the sleep, they're often moving around. They're not very still. If you look at a person in sleep and look at a person in meditation and see which one is physically more still, always the meditation is far more still. So even the physical formation is not all that still. Mental formation. No, because this goes through powerful states of mind before that final cessation happens. So remember, the things cease in proper order. When they cease in proper order, you get incredible bliss and power at the same time. The difference between the sleep states and the meditation states is the powerful mindfulness and the bliss which happens throughout. Okay, it's time to go. It's an hour and 45 minutes. I've really gone on a long time. So thank you for listening to this. You're most welcome to take this back with you because we don't need it. It's photocopied on behalf of the Buddhist Society of WA. So you can take it back and use it as a contemplation. When you go to a root of a tree, a forest, or a still place, you have something to do. So let's now pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, then we can go.
Arahaṃ sammāsambuddho bhagavā Buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādeyami Suvākato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho Sankhang Namami.